Big Lundy, welcome to the show.
Can you guys hear me?
Perfectly well, yes.
Fantastic. I wanted to discuss Sam Harris and objective morality here for a little bit. You guys touched on objective morality earlier.
Oh, we always touch on objective morality. It's one of our favorite things here. I don't know whether you were here at the beginning of the show. I do actually have, it's now under a stack of Bibles and copies of the Quran, but I do have his book. But as you will see, I've not really gone very far into it. So do go on.
I've got it as well, and I've bookmarked some several places that I think are very profound in my opinion.
Well, I've got about 10 in, and I've only got to page 24.
I personally feel that Sam Harris has a very substantial position when it comes to objective morality.
Is it substantially good or substantially in error?
I think that he has valid points to make when he formulates objective morality. A lot of people like to criticize the position that what he's doing is he's taking the subjective value of human well-being and placing an objective moral framework on that, and people say, you can't do that.
That has been my criticism, and I have been criticized for that criticism, so do carry on and be interested to hear. At the moment, so far as I've got, he's not really put a coherent definition of objective morality, so I can't really comment on it, but do go on.
Or I think the other aspect could be that it could be tautological, so you could have bad feelings are bad, right? Well, of course bad feelings are bad. I mean, that's their definition. So if suffering is connotated as a bad sensation, you want to say that bad sensations are bad, then duh, right? That's my only response to that.
I want Big to answer because he's obviously read more of the books than I have, but he does seem to be addressing it on the basis of human suffering and well-being. Big, do carry on.
Human suffering is generally characterized by Harris as bad, but he doesn't just say tautologically suffering is bad because suffering is bad because suffering is bad. He goes into big detail and as well as gives many sources for quantitative research in the area of why it is we don't like suffering, why it is that we don't want to experience negative brain states, why we consider those brain states to be negative in the first place. He gives a lot of citations as to why we do that. So I don't think that it's as simple as a tautology to say that suffering is bad, especially not as he expounds on it. As far as his definition of objective goes, when he says objective morality, he's what's called a moral realist. I share his position as a moral realist. That is that not that we can derive one answer that is completely 100% the correct answer to every single moral dilemma, but that we can come up with answers that are better than other answers. All you need to do in order to accept what he's saying is accept that there are good answers to a dilemma and bad answers to a dilemma.
I agree. That seems to be the message that I'm picking up from the book. But my problem is that if he's then using that or using objective to describe that, then I have a problem with that use of the word. And it may be, as I say, that my misunderstanding of his position is all down to his definition of objective, because what you've just described to me doesn't fit into any meaning of objective as I understand it.
Well, as he expands on objective, what he says by objective isn't exactly a new definition. It's been around for several hundred years. It's the same manner of objective that we use in mathematics, in all scientific research. What tends to be the disconnect that I've observed between other atheists rejecting what he's saying is that if you start from a subjective standpoint of a value, then you cannot derive an objective framework from that. And I don't think that that's true. I've given the example of if I value human well-being, and that is subjective, then I ought not run over people with my car for fun. But that's objective. I can objectively test whether or not running people over with my car for fun is going to be conducive to their well-being. That's an objective fact. Would that not be accurate?
Yeah, I completely agree with that statement.
No concordance wants to comment.
So I completely agree with that statement that you can objectively evaluate a subjective criteria. But there is no way, I mean, if you've got any background in philosophy that I can think of, I cannot think of a way in which a value system can be based on the independent of a mind, something inherent in the object with no need for a subject to perceive, that you could have a value system of any kind without a subject.
Well, I do actually have a background in philosophy. Currently, I'm a student. I'm going to be approaching post-grad work here soon enough, and I'm aiming for a PhD in the subject. So what I would say to that is that there are plenty of scientific things that we would consider to be objective that are based, that are mind-dependent. If you were to say that we cannot base objectivity on something that's mind-dependent...
Can you give us an example of what you're referring to so we've got some sort of handle?
Cognitive science.
You're saying that there are some things that are objective?
Well, the discoveries we make in cognitive science are mind-dependent, correct? We need a mind in order to make these discoveries.
That's trivial.
Yeah, I mean,
it may sound trivial, but
the things contain the properties. The things contain the properties. We are not evaluating the things. We as subjects have no part in that, right? So a pair of neurons, right, from a brain may have a certain property. But that's in the neurons. That's not in us looking at the neurons. Does that make sense? It's not in the subject. It's in the object.
Right, and this alludes to a higher problem that seems to be occurring, and that's the messy objective-subjective distinction. Sisyphus Redeemed is a philosophy professor, and he's expounded on this in a video where he criticized Bionic Dance for her critiques of Sam Harris, that it really is a very messy distinction to say that one thing is objective and one thing is subjective when you start from the position of if minds are dependent on whatever it is, then it's necessarily subjective. Because
let's see if we can clarify. What is your definition of objective and subjective?
Objective would be something that is true regardless of our input. And
see, I tend to agree with you on that.
But the thing is, we can come up with that level of objectivity given subjective values. And as I've already explained, that one of the examples of which would be, if I value human well-being, I ought not run over people with my car for fun. That's an objective moral fact.
But you smuggled in the subjective as a precondition.
I understand.
You're objectively evaluating a subjective morality. And I'm fine with that.
Can I just say welcome back
Sam
to the show, Michael? And I think we probably are picking up very much where he left off. Michael, we have been discussing other issues in the meantime, but welcome back to the show. I'm sorry, I interrupted, but isn't concordance right there? Because you have, as he says, smuggled in the subjective value.
I don't think it's smuggled in. I think it's very plain that we are putting in that subjective value. I just don't think that in any way delineates the objectivity that we can derive from any sort of moral statement.
You've come up with a criteria to evaluate whether or not you're achieving your morality. Right? You've come up with an objective measurement, and that's fantastic. But if you say that, let's say, a rock is pretty if it is symmetrical or if it is shiny. All right, shiny and symmetrical are objective properties because they're in the rock. But pretty is something that we decide. That is how we evaluate the prettiness of a rock. Do you see how you've got a complexity here? Anytime there's a judgment call being made, to me, that implies a subject, a mind, evaluating criteria, which makes it a subjective system.
See, now, I just disagree with the whole notion that as you've put it, smuggling in the subjective notion of a value of human well-being is in any way detrimental to the objectivity that we can give from any sort of moral statement. You drew a parallel from rocks being pretty if they hold certain properties, but we still think that our evaluation of what is pretty is still subjective. But that, to me, doesn't matter. I see a huge difference between saying rape is wrong because of X and Y and saying that a rock is pretty because of X and Y. Aesthetics and morality are two completely different subjects to be comparing the two.
Well, maybe that's our fundamental disagreement, and maybe it's because I'm a scientist and I have different perspectives, and I'm on a panel with two philosophy-type people. But I feel like I have it pretty. I mean, you know, you and I could disagree on what makes a pretty rock, because that's a subjective property, right? We could, I think, debate whether or not something was symmetrical, but it's something that can be measured objectively because it's a property of the object. I don't want to keep going in circles on this. I think we've each made a point. Let's try something else.
Okay. Well, Sam likes to draw his justification for placing a value on human well-being on the average of people in general across cultures, placing a value on human well-being. Now, that level of value that we place on these things can differ across cultures, but the fact is the value is still there. We all, across cultures, desire certain states of being. We have certain needs that need to be required in order for us to continue living, and we all desire to continue living, and we would consider those who don't desire to continue living to have some sort of mental problem. So to disregard the fact that – to disregard the entire idea of objectivity stemming from subjective value simply because that value is subjective, to me, that just – I don't know. That just doesn't – I don't see how you make that connection, how you draw that particular conclusion.
One of the things I'm hoping to find out in Sam's book is how he makes this measurement of what is human well-being. Can you throw any light on that? Give me a bit of a spoiler.
The measurement of human well-being. Well, firstly, before I do that, and I know this is kind of lame, but I'd like to clarify that I'm part of this other blog TV group called Trolling with Logic, and the guy who leads it wants to know if it's okay if he uploads his recording of my call to his channel, if that's okay with you.
Of course. Every part of this program is published on YouTube for anyone to use as they wish.
Fantastic. All right. Now, you asked how Sam Harris goes into the establishment of human well-being, and in general what he does is he establishes – through scientific data, that which humans require to have a positive brain state, what the criteria is to have that sort of positive brain state, and I'd have to read the words myself, and I can't.
I'll put it this way: I've always suspected, and I may be proved wrong, and you might be able to help me with this. I've always suspected that in making that analysis, he is using subjective values. And if he's using subjective values, then are we not in the same position again where that cannot ultimately lead to an objective value?
Well, here's what he's written when it comes to the psychology of happiness in his chapter, The Future of Happiness. I highlight this because I think this is very clear as to what he feels when it comes to people subjectively valuing things differently. To quote him, what does it mean, for instance, to compare self-reported ratings of happiness or life satisfaction between individuals or across cultures? I'm not at all sure. Clearly, a person's conception of what is possible in human life will affect her judgment of whether she has made the best use of her opportunities, met her goals, developed deep friendships, etc. Some people will go to bed tonight proud to have merely reduced their daily consumption of methamphetamine. Others will be frustrated that the rank in the Forbes 400 list has slipped into the triple digits. Where one is satisfied in life often has a lot to do with where one has been. So, to me, what he's clearly saying here is that we can, regardless of our differences, we recognize a sort of objective framework in which we recognize success and the opposite word to success is failure. So if we can objectively clarify what that means, if we can objectively clarify what it means to be satisfied with your life, then
That is at the heart of my problem with him. And what you've just read, I'm grateful for trying to clarify it, but it didn't clarify anything. It still seems to be somewhat subjective. And as someone posted in the comments on Blog TV, what does it mean to have a positive brain state? And maybe he goes into more detail. I want to bring Michael in because he's been sat patiently and I'm sure desperate to give us his views. Do you understand, Michael, Harris assesses happiness and well-being?
I think, by the way, is my audio better than it was before?
No, it's still appalling, but don't worry.
It's still shit? Okay. Sorry about that. So I think in the passage that was just read, he's kind of getting to the idea of the difference between instrumental goals and talent goals, or like the actual goal of things. So I think what Harris is essentially saying is that even though individual people have different instrumental ways of getting to happiness or to reduce suffering, we all agree that reducing suffering or making our lives better in some way is a worthy goal, regardless of how we go about doing that or what we consider an individual achievement along that path. Is that about right?
That's a subjective judgment, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's absolutely clear. And this is where a lot of people really get messed up with objective morality, is the difference between what are called in the literature talent goals versus instrumental goals. Everyone has different ways of achieving happiness. Like, that's just obviously true. Things that make me happy aren't going to make Concordance or you happy, Deepa. We're all different in that way. But that doesn't subtract from the general idea that suffering is bad, happiness is good, that truth is good, that there are other qualities that we've obviously assessed that are good. So, and that really is...
When you say that, truth is good. Truth is quite clearly not good in some circumstances. And the classic one that is...
Really?
Always,
that's
the classic one that is always given is... the Nazis are knocking on the house where Anne Frank is in the attic. Is it good to say, oh yeah, she's upstairs?
Mm-hmm.
So whenever anyone attempts to make these sort of like bold generalizations, there always seems to be an exception to it.
Well, I would like to clarify this, because Harris has actually written a book on lying, and he's actually used that particular example when it comes to him saying the lying is still, that there are still better options than to lie to the Nazis and say that they're that Anne Frank is in fact not in your attic. Now he clarifies that it's still preferable to lie to the Nazis, but it's not by default the best option simply because of the fact that you're lying. What happens here is we have different values contradicting each other, and which value takes precedence over the value of truth and the value of human well-being. Human well-being in general takes precedence over all of our other values, including that of truth. Truth is still important. Truth is still very valuable. It's just that we delineate that value when human well-being is at stake.
Okay. Maybe I'm confusing absolute with objective. I don't know, but
that's not a very uncommon objection that people tend to have, because Sam Harris redefines what objective means. He doesn't mean absolute. His whole book, Moral Landscape, is about the fact that there are multiple right answers to any moral problem.
Well, that's one of the things I picked up and actually put a yellow tab next to, is that he says quite clearly that he's not arguing that there's going to be a right answer to any particular moral dilemma, which is, I have to say, what I thought he may be arguing. But if he's not arguing that, then, as I say, he's using a definition of objective, which is one that I'm not familiar with.
I have to say, all of these arguments are fairly unpersuasive. For philosophers, I expected a more coherent and convincing argument. You both seem to have accepted this as self-evident. I don't get it. I don't feel it.
Well, you're likely to be tarred along with me, Concordance, as a philosophical illiterate.
What do they do to you people in college?
You wanted to come back, Bing.
I'd like to try and build some bridges here. What particularly is it that you don't find convincing about this formulation?
You don't seem to have explained away the fact that you keep smuggling in a goal right? You're not using the very definition of subjective that I think you agreed to.
But we're not
whether we were there or not, suffering is evil. Well, if we're not there, who is saying that suffering is immoral or wrong or whatever word we want to use? Who's saying it?
We are. We are the establishments of the emergent doctrine.
You see why I find that unpersuasive.
Well, I can see why you would find that I can see why you'd find that unpersuasive, but I don't think that your reasoning for finding it unpersuasive are very persuasive themselves. Again, the fact.
But why not? Because with this, I'm definitely with concordance. Your own subjective views, Michael.
Let
Big respond. It's only fair, and then we'll come to you, Michael. Big then Michael.
The whole idea that we're smuggling in a subjective value is completely irrelevant to me and to Sam Harris. He's fully aware that our value that we place on human well-being is subjective. He's not trying to explain that away and say that's not actually subjective. He's fully embracing the fact that that's subjective, but he's saying that that is a collective, intersubjective value that we hold.
Are you saying, as I have described previously, that he is using a summation of subjectivity to come up with something equating to objectivity? Because
no.
I've been criticized for that, and that seems to be exactly what you've just said.
No, what he's saying is that our intersubjectivity towards our value of human well-being is, in essence, sufficient justification to establish objective facts coming from that intersubjective value.
What's the difference between what you've just said and what I said?
Because you're saying that I'm saying that I'm saying that Sam Harris is saying this is completely convoluted. You're saying that Sam Harris is saying that intersubjectivity and agreed upon intersubjectivity equals objectivity, and that's actually not at all what he's saying.
Okay, fair enough. If that's not what he's saying, as I say, I'll have to read the book, but it sounded very much like it. Michael.
To go back to the question of who says that suffering is bad, that's the reason I keep laughing. I keep thinking of Bill O'Reilly with Neil deGrasse Tyson saying, "Who put the moon there?" it's the same
thing. Are you equating we with Bill O'Reilly?
Yeah, you're pissed off now.
You're done.
Do it live.
I'm okay. It's the you're the Bill O'Reilly of moral philosophy. We'll put it that way. Or you're O'Reillying the argument. Asking who, it's like the same question as who said that 5 + 5 = 10.
I'm sorry, Michael, if you're going to criticize me in such horrific terms, I think you need to do a little bit more to justify your position than say, who said 5 + 5 = 10. I accept. Weeks and months.
It's the same object to say that, Michael.
Illiterate. You called me the Bill O'Reilly. Come on.
You've got to be better
to justify it than that.
Well,
the five objects are equal to 10. Whether we're there to observe them or not.
No, they're not.
If we're not there to observe suffering, right, if there's no perception of it, who's making the value judgment? There's no value judgment in 5 + 5, besides the objective value.
Look,
there's no value
posting in the chat already, DPR O'Reilly. This is a major mistake. You're going to have to justify yourself, Michael.
Well, I just have to... I create.
If the best you can do is 5 + 5 = 10, I'm not convinced.
But that's what I'm pointing out is the issue is that you're not convinced, and you should be. Like, if you can answer for me why, like, who said, like, who put the moon there and who made 5 + 5 = 10, then it would be the same answer for who made suffering a bad thing.
Which question are you referring to that I put to you?
Maybe
your faculties were too limited that you didn't understand the grammar of my question.
Maybe. It was the central question of who it is that defines these properties. It is a circular argument because you're assuming that it has to have someone to do it, which is precisely the matter that's at stake. I'm sorry, but it is pretty much an amateur mistake.
I want to clarify here. What he's saying is that you already accept that suffering is bad. And then you say, who is it that says that suffering is bad? Which is sort of,
what I'm doing is questioning how you define suffering.
Well, suffering in general.
I'm sorry if that's
we don't need a question,
but.
Something clarifies, we don't need a, before I go into this, we don't need a complete clear-cut definition of what is suffering in order to understand that running people over with your car causes suffering. Would you at least agree with that?
Yes, I'm happy with that.
So, clearly, I don't need to objectively, completely, clear-cutly define what suffering is, and neither, and Sam Harris, by the way, and this is my answer, he doesn't do that either, and goes ahead and admits this is not supposed to be an end-all, be-all to the moral question of what is good and what is bad. I'm simply offering this as conversation, and you can respond how you like.
And I have, and apparently it's in a manner not dissimilar to Bill O'Reilly, but there we go. I have to say, Concordance kindly has reminded me of the time. We're overrun by 25 minutes. I would really like this conversation to carry on, and don't worry, I have no problem being insulted or criticised or questioned. The bit I write was bloody below the belt there, Michael. I'm going to have words with you after the show about that. I think if we can do it this way, Big Lundy, it'd be really interesting if we could have you back on a future show. As I say, we've got... and this is for the benefit also of those who were not here at the beginning of the show, we have Theoretical Bullshit, AC Grayling, and Potholer lined up. None of them have actually confirmed any particular date, but we're hoping to get them on the next three shows. And it may be appropriate to have you back on one of those shows so we can certainly discuss that. And in fact, if you stay on the call, once we finish the show, we can talk further.
Sure.
I think, though, given the time, we will have to wrap it up there, but I was always keen to give the callers and the panellists their final words. So, JR, you've been somewhat mute, and without any form of disrespect, I'm going to remove you because your call was in relation to something somewhat different. So we'll take Big Michael. No, that's unfair. We'll take Concordance Michael and give you the last word, Big. And as I say, once we stop the show, please stay on the line and we'll talk about future shows. Concordance.
I don't have much to say. It's been a good discussion. We ought to kick Thunder and RN off on a regular basis to see what kind of discussions we get. And it's their fault for not being here.
Absolutely. And again, if people would like to comment, you can do it on the YouTube. It's actually, if you've got a point to make, it's better to go to the link on the banner to the website and send one of us a message from that. That does actually guarantee that we will receive it. So if you've got any comments or suggestions to make, please do that. Michael.
Oh, I think kicking Aaron and Thunder off on a regular basis would be excellent.
I think that would be true whether
we could apprehend the truth or not.
Is it objectively correct to kick that? Oh, no, stop. Thanks. Big, your last words, Big.
I just want to say that to anybody who is still questioning Sam Harris's formulation, I just want to say that so long as you accept that there are good actions and bad actions and answers to moral questions that are good and answers that are not as good as others, then I don't see sufficient reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, when it comes to Sam Harris.
I have to come back very briefly before we ask Tony to close the show. I have not said that. I have argued whether he is describing can be correctly described as objectivity. On that note, on that bombshell, we will close the show. Can I thank very much Tony, who again is working away behind the scenes to bring this show to you in all its glory, high quality, high definition, and superb audio quality. Thank you very much, Tony. Could I ask you to pull the plug on the show? We will be back in 2 weeks with possibly Potholer, possibly AC Grayling, or possibly Theoretical Bullshit, and probably Big Lundy as well. Take care, everyone. See you in 2 weeks.